you heard me, Marine. Sound off.
One, two.
I said sound off.
Whoa, Hicks, you hear that?
Sound off.
Yeah, sound off. Two, three, four.
I said sound off now. Come on.
What say you, Hicks? What do you think?
Hudson, sir. He's Hicks.
Bleeding. Cops and bleeding was the best day. Watching that movie on the Lethal Mullet.
G'day guys, how you going? Welcome to the one and only Lethal Mullet Network's Lethal Mullet Podcast, the flagship show here on, of course, the one and only network, which you've just been told about, folks. I'm your host, Adam O'Brien, the Lethal Mullet, coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina, the Gold Coast of Australia. And now that I've got that out of my bloody mouth, we're going to invite our dear pal all the way from the UK, the one, the only, the great writer, the Farsight blogger, the one, the only RPG designer, Jonathan Hicks. Bane, how you going?
I'm all right, mate. How are you?
Good, good, mate. I tell you what, I'm ready to chat some Waylon Utah and I.
Oh, don't say that. I'm really Cambridge Wallace. In a few years, you'll understand what that means.
Mate, tell us how you've been, mate. What's happening in the UK?
Well, the weather's really nice. Sun's beating down, which means it's going to rain soon, and everything's going to turn miserable again. But other than that, I've just been busy writing, doing work for my game, Those Dark Places. And that's pretty much it. How's things going down there?
It's about the same. I'm going to say, well, you know, we're having the other end of the spectrum where you guys have had this beautiful sunshine, humidity, and, you know, basically be by the beach weather, which you just want to be. You want to be out there hanging 10 going, whoa, man, it's gnarly out here, dude. You know,
but, that's how we all talk in the UK.
Yeah, apparently.
The thing is, we've literally been discussing this and you just told me it was 3 degrees where you are. And I'm thinking, no, that's Australia. I don't believe you. Because in Australia, it's hot all year round, and we know this because we've seen it on the telly.
Oh, it's crazy. It really is. Like, honestly, in our usual, even winter weather here, you can go around in a pair of, you know, shorts and a tank top, and you still will be warm.
Oh, mate.
You know you got to listen. Long, long days ahead, working in front of a VHS.
G'day, mate. How you going? Welcome to the Lethal Mullet Network, where you'll find all these amazing shows and more. Where you'll find the Lethal Mullet Podcast, a celebration of action cinema from the 80s, 90s, and beyond. You'll also find Making Treks, a Star Trek fan podcast, where I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Mark Newbold, into a deep dive of Star Trek. You can also find Mullet and Kilt, a look at music, where I'm joined by my dear pal, Darth Elvis. And where you can also find The Mullet Guild, a look at the Dune universe. All here on, of course, LethalMulletNetwork.podbean.com or on your favourite podcatcher. You can find us there. You can also find all these shows a week later on, of course, the one, the only Fandom Podcast Network, FPN, on fpnet.podbean.com. Folks, today we're going to have a bit of a special chat because Jonathan's brought it to us that we need to dissect the universe of course, of the Xenomorph. Of course, better known as Alien. It's got a huge, huge following, folks, because Ridley Scott gave us a film back in 1979, which really, I think, was the best haunted house in space ever. And it's definitely influenced people like Jonathan himself, which have got those great games like Those Dark Places, which we'll talk about a little bit later too. One of the great things about that film, I think, was that people weren't ready for a slow film. Which it is. It's Texas Chainsaw Massacre in space.
Yeah. I mean, people have been going to cinema and they'd... Well, at the end of the day, it was the era of Star Wars. So, mm-hmm. I mean, let's face it, Alien only got made because Star Wars was so successful and Fox just wanted whatever space film was lying on the desk at the time. Alien cropped up. So, I mean, if you were going to the cinema at that time expecting sort of this fast, frenetic action and strange explosions and all sorts of stuff, it simply wasn't going to happen. So, yeah, it must have been a bit of a shock for everybody that this weird, slow, dark, almost Euro art house science fiction horror movie suddenly appeared on the screen and basically set the standard for those kind of movies.
Oh, totally. And I've got to say, Alien wasn't the first one I saw. I saw Aliens first.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a weird story. I was watching Enter the Dragon on free-to-air TV back in the 80s. And
awesome film.
I'm like, wow, this is, you know, great fight. It was just between when Sammo Hung and Bruce are having that big, almost like an MMA fight at the start. And yeah. Bruce is owning him, you know, putting all the old arm bar and smacking into him. And great fight. And then the in comes Winnie Blue's ad. Winfield Blue, make sure you smoke your smokes, man. You know, all that sort of stuff comes on TV. I'm like, I don't want to watch this. And anyway, changing channels. And I'm on channel 9. I remember it vividly. Was the scene where Vasquez and Drake were locking up their smart guns, ready to rock and roll. Yeah. And then I think it was Frost. It was pumping action, the M41A pulse rifle. I'm like, whoa, what is that movie? And that's, I was hooked because I kept flicking between channels. And I feel like, well, I was going to go to the video shop that weekend after school and just go, I've got to get this movie out. I've got to see what this is. And then I put it on and then, and then the Aliens logo comes up, boom. And then straight away we're peering through space and it's the most amazing space I've ever seen because we've got this weird blue gassy nebulae around and never got done in Star Wars, was done in Star Trek a little bit with Wrath of Khan, but this is mysterious and dark and twisted. There's always blue with James Cameron, but...
different. I think that was the thing. It looked different. I mean, you look at the original Starfield and Alien, it was just black and white dots. It's like that in most things, but this was different. It felt like a place. So I think a lot about James Cameron, the way that he made his films, was the fact that he gave everything a sense of character.
Oh, yeah.
So when he films something, there's like a history behind it. You know what I mean? There's a lot of depth to it. So that first shot of Aliens, when you see the Narcissus drifting, there's this strange wisp in the background. So straight away, you're asking questions, not about what's happened on the Narcissus, because you already know what's happened from the previous film, but where is it? What's it doing there? How did it get there? Et cetera. So no, Cameron's really good at building up those kind of, that kind of tension.
And I love that little character that pops up, and he goes, well, there goes the salvage, guys.
And with that one line, that tells you everything you need to know about that guy, his crew, and his ship.
Yeah, totally.
It's really good. It's really, really well made. No, I first came across Alien in July of 1982.
Oh.
And it was the first UK network showing of the film. I think the World Cup was on at the time. Football World Cup. And I remember seeing an advert. I can't remember what I was watching. But it was late at night. So I was only 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing an advert. And it came up and it was showing these different clips. And I was a massive Star Wars fan.
Yeah.
So all my Star Wars posters, I had the Star Wars read-along book and all this sort of stuff. So this thing comes up, we see this weird ship. I remember the announcer saying, the alien knows where you are and he knows you're afraid. And I'm thinking, what the hell is this? I need to see this film. But being 11 years old, it was on at 9:30 at night, because that was well past my bedtime. I had school the next day. So I remember sneaking a old portable black and white television upstairs into my bedroom, and I ended up watching it on that. And it's a black and white, you know how deep the shadows are in Alien. So watching on black and white, it was just even worse. So of course, I'm 11 years old, lying in the bed with my duvet or a blanket over my head, trying to watch the TV and keeping the noise down. I knew they were watching it downstairs, but I was trying to keep the volume down so nobody knew that I was watching it. And basically just wetting my pants. And they're thinking, I can't watch that. And next day, we're at school talking about it, you know, all the kids that are allowed to see it. And then me thinking, I can never watch this film again, because it just scared me so much. And then, 4 years later, well, 3 years later, because I was lucky, when Aliens came out in 86,
mm-hmm.
I was there on the opening night.
Again,
we had the trailers coming up. So I was 15 years old at the time, and to be a 15-year-old kid, watching a movie like that in the cinema, in a packed cinema, was just, the revelation was just insane. It is. And it always will be my favourite 1980s action thriller movie. It is just so well made. It's brilliant. However, this is my only proviso. In later life, and probably thanks to the Alien quadrilogy box set with those amazing Star Beast, all the background making of documentaries. I came to realise Aliens, as much as I love it, it is a fantastic movie, but it's not a very good sequel to the themes and mm-hmm. the ideas that the original put in place. Now, I completely understand that James Cameron had to make his own film. There's no point in carrying on where he left off. And obviously, Cameron had his own ideas for his own film. Well, he wanted a war movie in space, let's face it.
Yeah.
So, and that's what he made, and that's what he got, and he did a great job of it. I have to keep stressing that. But if I was a massive Alien fan, and my entire... Well, I am a massive Alien fan. But if my entire love of Alien was surrounded by the way the first film was made, with that kind of Euro art house, dark, slow build-up of tension, and I mean, let's face it, just about every single shot that Ridley Scott makes in any film, you just stick it in a frame and stick it on your wall.
Of course,
he's the guy. These guys' art is—he's never been surpassed in my eye. But uh-huh. Of course, I'm biased. But he's absolutely brilliant. If I'd watched that and then went to see Aliens,
yeah.
I probably wouldn't have enjoyed Aliens. If I'd have been expecting that same level of tension, that same level of atmosphere, I wouldn't have got that from the film from Aliens as a movie. It created its own way of doing things. Of course, the offshoot of that being that is that now everybody thinks of Aliens and Xenomorphs, all they're thinking about, yes, they're thinking of Aliens, but they're also thinking about guys with M41A sort of pulse rifles, you know, with 10mm caseless studded light armor piercing rounds. And it's just like, that's nice, that's great, but that's not all that Alien is. And it took until Alien Isolation, the computer game, when that came out.
Yeah.
And that, the story behind that, the way that continued those themes, instead of it being another story of it hunting down people on a ship,
yeah.
It actually opened up its hunting ground to an entire space station. And how would that affect all the people still on that station? Mm. And what would they do to survive when it's there? I even like the conceit that the person that you were playing was Ripley's daughter. And that kind of worked out in a weird way. And I know it's brand recognition using the name Ripley, but it really worked.
Yeah.
And I played that through a couple of times, then I realised that Alien Isolation was actually my personal preferred sequel to Alien. If they'd made that as a movie, and used the elements of that as a movie, I probably would have loved that even more than Aliens. But I'm going to be honest with you, I do like it more than Aliens, because I'm such a huge fan of what the original movie set up, that anything that came after it, yeah, you've got to live up to that. But like I say, Aliens, still an amazing movie. It's still my favourite 1980s action movie.
I've got to say,
how I feel about that.
I actually totally 100% agree with you. And there's a reason why is that, yeah, the story elements from the first one were not carried through in Aliens in any way. I mean, yeah, you had a through line of Ripley. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Getting picked up. But she was just thrown into a completely different set of circumstances that, to me, that should have been the last movie in the series. Aliens should have been then Weyland-Yutani in particular have dissected this beast, found out where it's come from. The events of these prequels too would have information coming into that. So the fact that they know that the androids are pretty much the ones that created that race.
That particular storyline, sorry to interrupt, that's the particular storyline with David being the supposed creator doesn't work for me at all.
No.
But we'll go into that later on.
Yeah, but what Jim should have done is, yeah, something more along the lines of what you see in Isolation personally. Because to me, Alien 3, not as a movie, but more as setting it in a place like that. You know, it's closer to the original film, except they've got nothing they can use. And that's why I love that element. You know, they've got to use their brains. They've got to scourge around this forgotten hospital or whatever it is. It's definitely not an actual prison. It's just a make-do prison, pretty much. Fiorina 161, you know, this place where everything just... And where was it? It was somewhere in the UK near... where they make boats and stuff like that, from what I remember, the front of it anyway.
I don't remember. I do know where it's on the coast. Well, the inspiration for that opening shot and all the cranes. Alien 3 is a great film. It really is. I prefer the assembly cut than I do the theatrical cut.
Yeah, it's a good cut.
Film really sort of contained and really, there's sort of plot elements which sort of unfold and you're thinking, I don't quite understand how they got to this point. But when you watch the assembly cut, it makes so much more sense. And they put the whole sort of, oh, it's a dragon and you know, it's coming here to kill us. Sort of theme, what have you. Absolutely, it's really well done. My only problem with it being that they killed off Hicks and Newt. There was no reason.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
To be honest with you.
Who was in that film?
Kids say it's nihilistic. Alien is always nihilistic. It really, really isn't. You've obviously not watched the last 5 minutes of Aliens. So it's just that kind of, I don't fully understand why they did that. I know they wanted to do a bit of a shock and massive introduction.
Yeah.
It's back to the old way of doing things.
Oh, yeah.
But that kind of makes, if you're following on with that, then Alien 3, that opening 10 minutes, kind of makes Aliens completely pointless. I don't understand the reasoning behind that. That's always struck me as a little bit strange.
Who's in that movie? That movie?
In what story?
Doctor Who is in that movie. There you go, gotcha.
Psycho. And it's really, really good.
It's
and
good.
I can't understand why they cut that out of the theatrical release. Because that entire sequence of him and going into the chamber where they've trapped it and letting it out and all this sort of stuff, all spoilers. You know, that entire sequence, I cannot for the life of me figure out why it is that they left that out. But it is a great film, and they should have ended it there. That's where they should have ended it.
Yeah,
they should have ended it at Alien, but they should have ended Alien. If they were going to do any more Aliens, then they should have ended it at the end of Alien 3 and just left it at that.
Alien Resurrection's like a spoof of Alien. Like, I tried rewatching it the other day, and... I watched Alien Resurrection the other day, and it's like a really bad spoof that doesn't understand what it's spoofing.
The thing with Alien Resurrection for me is that I think visually it's quite stunning. The design work in there is absolutely fantastic.
It's nice.
I like the design of the alien. I think the alien looks really, really cool. I think the alien looks really good. I love the fact that it's almost black on that screen. Mm. Absolutely fantastic. I love the design of the Betty. The Betty is a beautifully designed
car. Yeah.
The whole design ethic behind the entire film is fantastic. I just don't understand it. It felt like a computer game. That's how it felt to me. There was no sense of threat.
No.
You know what I mean? There was action sequences and what have you, but there was no sense of threat because people were doing just weird things. And the camera shots were a bit strange as well. And the whole thing with the hybrids with the alien newborn. I think I switched off. The best scene in that is when she finds all the versions of herself in that room and then sets fire to.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a fantastic performance from Sigourney Weaver. And visually, it was absolutely stunning. Quite heartbreaking in many respects. But after that, it just went mental. And that entire sequence on the ship where the guy goes, the chest burst is about to come out, so the guy shoots him, and then he starts banging his head, and he holds his head against his chest, and it bursts out. I'm like, what is going on?
Yeah, no.
Come on, guys. And it's just, Alien Resurrection, I just can't.
I can't do it either.
I try not to be down on films, with that one I simply just can't. At that point I realise that's it now. It's all about the money in the first place.
Oh, totally.
But then I kind of, yeah.
You know, it's funny, though, after that we got, obviously, before Prometheus, we got a couple of these weird Aliens versus Predator films, which are... I don't know what to say. I mean, they are really fanfic. I mean, that's what it is. I don't consider them part of the series.
Absolutely not. I don't consider... I've never considered the universes to be part of each other anyway. Those were just a bit of fun. The first one I didn't like.
Yeah.
Second one I've watched once and about never to watch it ever again. I watched the first one again recently, and you know, it's not actually that bad a film. It's an entertaining action adventure movie. And the entire sequence at the end with the Queen smashing through the snow looks absolutely stunning. Look, it looks really, really good. But it just seemed to be a lot of ideas. It felt like a lot of ideas thrown together by somebody who watched the Alien and Predator movies 20 years previously and then were trying to make notes from what they remembered. Because there was nothing in those films which paid any homage at all, other than visually, to what the Alien and Predator movies were about. So, and some of the decisions there, again, I couldn't quite fathom. But then again, they were just looking to get the kids into this. That's why it was a 15 rated, wasn't it? Or was it 12 or something like a PG rated movie?
Yeah, it was like a PG-13.
Basically, you could take your family, you know, your older family. To me, that's like, no, that straight away, that kind of reduces the importance of both franchises. But I've never, ever considered Alien vs. Predator. Other than even the comics, the Dark Horse comics from 1990, which were excellent, by the way. I absolutely adored them. But I've never considered them in the same universe. If you want to go down that route, then you can say that Superman exists in the same universe as well, because he's fought the alien. So Judge Dredd is fought the alien. And again, Judge Dredd's fought Batman. So if Batman's fought Judge Dredd's fought, then that means Batman also exists in that universe. Do you know what I mean? None of it. So it's just a little bit of fan fiction. And I think the sooner that they get separated and get put back into their own franchises, the better. Because they deserve more than what they were given as far as that's concerned. Although, saying that, I think the best film since Predators had come out for the Predator franchise was Predators. On that alien world where they've been under. I thought that was a really, really good film. It sort of loses its way about two-thirds of the way through, and the ending's a little bit predictable.
But it was a really entertaining film. Why would they cast Adrian Brody in a Charles Bronson-like performance? The guy was so non-convincing. Like, everyone else was fine in the film.
Absolutely, and I don't get that. To be honest with you, I quite liked him in that performance because he wasn't what you were expecting.
Well, that part's
but
good.
He wouldn't have been my first choice.
Nah. Like, Christian Bale? Maybe Bale? Maybe somebody like, I mean, I'm not saying Tom Hardy, but somebody like that sort of, you know, a bit more rebellious, a bit more rough around the ears, people that you could throw in the mud and they'll get back up and wash themselves off and get into it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I think that's the key.
Also, I think the gun that he was toting was actually bigger than he was, wasn't it? So was it an automatic shotgun or something?
The AA-12 fully auto Tommy gun like 75 round 12 gauge. That thing you can hold with one arm and fire comfortably. That's how light it is.
Oh, right, okay. Just didn't look that way on screen. It obviously worked out for the role. But I think that was a good film. But no, the Alien vs. Predator films, anything Alien vs. Predator, no, I can't.
Same. I've watched them once each.
Fan fiction, it is a lot of fun.
But it is.
I can't imagine officially those two universes coexisting. It just doesn't feel right to me. It's just because there was a bit of an Easter egg in a movie once, mm-hmm. and you know what I mean. And people got a bit carried away, I think.
Totally. And of course, one of the big thing is we've got coming up is Ridley coming through and going, what on God's earth are these guys doing with my franchise? And he literally said that at a film convention, and Fox himself said, well, what have you got, Ridley? What have you got? And he said, well, you guys are going in the wrong area. We need to find out where this all came from. Of course, we got, in 2012, a film which I actually think is definitely the better of the two that they've done. It's still got a lot of plot holes in it. It still doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense. Prometheus.
Yes. It's a good film, okay?
Yeah.
Once again, visually stunning. You can't go wrong with that. But once again, there was loads of decisions that I don't quite understand. When they kept talking about we need to know where these aliens come from, my first thought was, no, you don't. One of the great things about Alien, when they're going into that ship, when they're going into the space jockey, when they find the egg chamber below the ship, everything about it is you cannot even begin to imagine. That's what made it so terrifying. It was very Lovecraftian. You know what I mean? It bent your mind out of shape. You can't imagine where this came from, why it came about, and that's what made the alien terrifying. You know, the fact that it could murder somebody and then turn them into an egg, so that another one would come out and then murder someone and hit that cycle going, is to me far more scary than an alien queen. I think Alien Queen was just a boss fight. It was a bit of a cop-out, to be honest with you. And I think about the Alien Queen and the alien drones as well, and sort of looking at it like an ant's nest, is because using that kind of metaphor, you've suddenly got your real-world reference.
Yes.
So now you can just say, actually, they're giant ants. So they're no more threatening or dangerous than the ants out of them.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So you just shoot them and then move on.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, in the original movie, this thing was unstoppable. And I'd like to think as well that its life cycle was a little bit more twisted and weird, which it originally was, than just having a queen laying eggs for everybody to run around with, like giant ants. So, you didn't need those questions answered. Also, the space jockey grew out of the chair, so the idea that this entire ship... So who grew the space jockey? Did the space jockey grow the ship around itself? Or did the ship, being sentient, grow the space jockey to pilot it? You don't know. That's the mystery. That's what was terrifying. That's what was scary about it. But now they're just big guys in suits. And all that mystery and all that strangeness and sort of like... I come back to the word Lovecraftian strangeness and that kind of cosmic horror... has now just gone because it's just a bunch of guys in suits. You know what I mean? It just kind of sucked the life out of it for me. And I don't understand why they went with those decisions. Now, I applaud Prometheus for trying something different. Because let's face it, people keep saying, oh, Prometheus has ruined the franchise. And I'm like, no, mate, you need to go back 20-odd years. The franchise was ruined a long time ago. Ridley Scott had nothing to do with ruining the franchise. No, that was you put that in the hands of other people, in the hands of other filmmakers, comic writers, publishers, everything. They were doing things like dolphin aliens and rhino aliens, and sorry. You want to go back 20 years. The franchise was in trouble a long time ago. The franchise was in trouble when Alien vs. Predator came out. They were so desperate that they combined with another franchise to get into work. So But to turn around and say that, that Ridley Scott ruined the franchise is a little bit disingenuous, if that's the word. So I think what he tried to do, and I, this is something I appreciate, is that he tried to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, you know, yes, he wanted to explore the history of it, but he also wanted to explore other aspects of the universe as well.
That's right.
And I understand that, because there's no point in just going over old ground and say, oh, look, scary alien, because we've been there, we've done that countless times. Let's do something different. And I get that. I just don't think that, personally, I don't think that some of the ideas and the way that it was executed in some respects was done really well. I don't think it did the history of the alien any favours, really. And then Covenant just kind of compounded that.
Biggest problem is that, I think, well, it goes back to the budget of this thing. Like, it was such a huge film. And him coming back to the franchise, Fox were pretty, you know, happy. They said, look, let's give this guy some cash, you know. Let's really milk it.
Yeah, totally.
And you know Ridley, I mean, you know, ever since Gladiator, I mean, that was him coming back to really, you know, get up there. I mean, and he's been basically like a yo-yo ever since, still to this day. There's never been a really great film. American Gangster getting up there a little bit again. And, you know, and then
The
Martian. The Martian, 100%. Yeah, I mean, that's a far better film than Prometheus. I mean, it really is.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's just a shame he never did Blade Runner 2049. I think at the end of the day, probably thank God he didn't, because he wouldn't have been ready to make that one. Denis Villeneuve just smashed that over the head.
He went out of the park and into orbit. I think I can't imagine anybody else of making that. Well, of course you can't, he made it. I think their God did such an amazing job of that. I couldn't imagine anybody else making that, not even Ridley Scott. I love Ridley Scott to bits, don't get me wrong. Sure that if it followed the same story beats, then perhaps we would have had something stunning. But what we needed for Blade Runner 2049 was a fresh voice, was a fresh vision. And I think that's what we need for Alien, we need a fresh vision. Now, I appreciate Blomkamp doing what he wanted to do, but again, it was basically trading off the stuff that came out of Aliens, and what we need for Alien. I don't want a reboot. I just want a fresh set of eyes on it.
You know who we need?
I think I interrupted while you were chatting.
I get very passionate
about these sort of things. I end up blurting shit out, so you carry on.
You've gone down a rabbit hole here, which we're going to continue because I like this. We're talking about fresh voices. I think it does need a fresh voice, but what it needs is a voice that's been with it since day one, 1979. Dan O'Bannon was part of it, obviously, getting this thing rolling. Yep. But there was, of course, a couple of producers. And, of course, one of them was Walter Hill, the American director. Yeah. He's always had his mind. Now, he's done his own of these sort of films called Supernova, which was an absolute turkey. I mean, it was an absolutely shocking film. It looked good. But, I mean, I watched about three quarters of it the first time. I went, meh. I tried it a couple of years later and still went, meh. You know, and all I've got to say is this guy is a fantastic director, particularly with ensemble casts, 48 hours, another 48 hours. You name it. This guy's done it. Warriors, and it just keeps going. Long Riders, like these great films. He
Last
needs.
Man Standing, genius.
Oh, Last Man Standing, but he needs to take a cast like that, throw it in the Alien universe, and he needs to get off his bum and actually do an Alien film.
Yeah. I would like to see the obvious person is Denis Villeneuve. I would love to see Denis Villeneuve in an Alien film. Saying that, I would love to see David Fincher come back and try again.
Yeah.
If he was given free rein to do it again with his visuals, the way that he shoots stuff. I mean, I was looking at the way that he shot Seven, which is absolutely great, absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. Not my kind of film, I'm not going to lie. But visually, absolutely stunning. But then you see how he shoots films like The Social Network. That film was just shot so amazingly well.
Yeah.
Some of the setup shots were absolutely beautiful. I could honestly see him. I know that he had a bad experience with Alien 3, and I know that he swore off it. I mean, you know what I mean? But I would love to see him come back and have another stab, have another go. But after his work on Arrival and Blade Runner 2049, I think Denis Villeneuve would... And basically get the franchise back on track.
Yeah, definitely.
Personally, I think it's too late to save the franchise now. You know what I mean? You've got all these different factors from the outside... Yeah. Association with Predator. There's no way that franchise is coming back to the way that it used to. You won't go back to the purity of how it used to be. We're never going to go back to those days.
No, it's not going to happen.
1986. That's when it changed. But at least get it back on track as far as the feeling towards it's concerned. not only people's attitude towards it, the atmosphere, mm-hmm. the long lingering shots. I think that's something that annoys me about modern cinema, and this is just me going off on track here, is the fact that the edit's so fast. Quick reaction shot, quick reaction shot. What's this look like? What's that look like? And then you sit down and watch Denis Villeneuve's 2049, and there's long, beautiful, lingering shots on certain aspects. That's what I'm looking forward to in Dune. I hope he does that in Dune. I really want him to do that sort of thing in Dune. And that's what we need. We need a movie that we can absorb. Yes. At the moment, most movies just seem to be cultural, consumer, you know, get them in, get them to watch it, consume the food, get them out the door, get the next load in. No, we need something. We need cinema to be a theatre again. We need intermissions. We need to be able to go in and sit down and absorb the film and enjoy it and not just be told, quick, get out, we've got another load of people coming to see it, because we need to make as much money as possible. That's what we need. I'm sorry, I went off on a complete tangent.
You've headed down a tangent, which we're going to have to follow now, folks. He's talked about Denis Villeneuve. Denis Villeneuve is, without a doubt, not only just a saviour, he's a true artist, and this artist, from all reports, is not only knocked it out of the park with Dune, he's actually finally been the director to be able to translate the film now. It's only half the book, so a lot of people got to remember there's still a second part to do. And as far as we know, it hasn't been confirmed the second one's going to be made. Obviously, they're going to probably see how it goes. But at this stage, it's pretty much bang for buck. This thing will get out there, and it'll do great guns September. There's some weird reactions from some of the test screenings, though. And the reactions are that it's not Star Wars. It's not Star Wars. Yeah. Well, it's not meant to be, folks, because this is closer to The Godfather than there is because of what's involved. If you think about it, you know, it's like Sollozzo and all that. Harkonnen are trying to kill off this little empire or this family, this mafioso, you know. There's so much involved, more like a mafia film than a Star Wars film. And then, of course, then there's the military combat of this thing, which looks just breathtaking. From what I'm hearing, the Harkonnens are finally given a real, and I mean a real, life to them. So you think about it, their atmosphere is going to be completely different from the likes of Arrakis or in the the case of Culloden and other planets where their atmosphere is really terrible. So they've got to wear spacesuits, basically, with oxygen and all that sort of stuff when they come down. So, I mean, Villeneuve's really thought about this, not like Lynch going, I think they should have leather jackets. I think they should have gas masks. Gas masks are cool. We did them on Twin Peaks. They're really cool, you know. You know, and I love Lynch. Don't get me wrong. I think he's fantastic.
Lynch's version, Lynch's visuals were how I imagined Dune for a very, very long time. Because, I mean, they were stunning. They looked great.
Oh, yeah.
Design work, especially the interior of House Caladan, which on the castle.
Oh, yes.
Beautiful. The costumes were amazing. Really, really good. But my only problem with that is it's just changes to the book. I mean, I saw the film before I properly read the book.
Yeah.
So I can, and of course, the older I get, the more that I read the book, the more I realised I wish they'd kept this in the original film. So when Sci-Fi did their limited series about 20 years ago now, which was very good, and it was a great great interpretation. Design wise, didn't really do it for me. So yep. I'm looking forward to something special in Villeneuve's Dune.
Oh, look, it's good.
And again, coming back to our main topic, and that's why I think you should make another Alien film.
Oh yeah.
And try and use his skills to recapture the elements of what made the original great. I think that's what he did with Blade Runner 2049. Mm-hmm. He made it his own film. He wasn't trying to pay homage. He wasn't trying to copy or otherwise sort of reconstruct what Ridley Scott had done. Back with the original movie, he made it his own film. He took all his cues from the original film, well, of course, you've got to take your cues from that, Blade Runner, and then made it his own. And I would love to see him do that with Alien and make it his own. And again, they're doing an Alien TV show, and I was pushing for ages about doing an Alien Isolation TV show. A 10-episode run, just like 3 or 4 episodes actually set on the station, but then all the other episodes set around it. What's happening with Wayne Yutani and Deegson, and you know what I mean? And the build-up to her finding her mom. And sort of Amanda Ripley as a young girl growing up without a mom. Why has her mom not come back? And that would have been great. I think that would have been fantastic. But they are doing another TV show now. And, the looks of it, it's going to be on Earth. And that kind of I lost interest straight away. The thing what makes Alien scary is being out there in the deep, dark black, in the middle of nowhere, with absolutely no help coming, and you've got shit going down.
Yeah.
Sit it on Earth. How am I going to get away? I'm just going to run out the door and jump in the car and drive off. You know what I mean? It's all those, all that threat and a sense of isolation, claustrophobia and terror, it's gone out the window. But I don't know. I mean, that's just me being judgmental because I've only heard rumours. And I do try not to make...
It'd be the alien xenomorphs running down the side of the Thames, going down to Big Ben.
Yeah, look, my issue is, if I think about aliens on Earth, all I can think about is, Alien versus Predator Requiem. and that's what comes into my head. And straight away, straight after I've swallowed the vomit that's just coming into my mouth, I then start thinking, how's this going to work? And to me, it also feels a little bit... And this is going to sound horrible, and I do apologise, but it sounds lazy.
It is.
We're going to sit on Earth. What?
It's just cheap.
Production cost that the, down the street.
They do it for the dollars. It's cheaper.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's all it is.
So, but you know, if it works and it gets it out there, he does well, then absolutely brilliant. And I'll sit down and watch it. But right now, that kind of, I don't know, it's not got me excited, put it that way. The sisterhood, the Bene Gesserit sisterhood TV show got me more excited than that. And I'm an absolutely huge Alien fan. You would have thought I'd be chomping at the bit for an Alien TV show. But I need to hear more before I can make an informed decision.
I got to say, look, it can be done because we've got, you know, shows like The Expanse, for example, which is probably my favourite TV show right now, except for alongside that, maybe The Boys or Cobra Kai, you know, those three shows really hold it together. But you've hit on something we should talk about, which is the influence of this series. And, definitely need to talk about your book, obviously, too. But let's have a look at it. Like this film really did. It was influenced by Darkstar, obviously, itself.
Yeah.
But then it was an influence on films like the underwater stuff, like Leviathan.
Yeah. There's a film come out recently. I don't know if you've seen it, called Underwater with Kristen Stewart.
Ah.
And it kind of got buried because of the buyout of Disney and Fox and this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it got a really limited January release. And I saw it last year. And it is absolutely fantastic. And it is really, really, really good. I was actually quite stunned. But it goes through your usual weird alien kind of steps. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's nothing unpredictable about it. So you got a bunch of people trying to survive, die one by one in different ways, blah, blah, blah. The ending is excellent. I absolutely love the ending. It's actually really, really good. If you like Cthulhu, you'd love that. But talking about influences, aliens' influences, I wonder if it can be felt back with the Corman films from the early 80s. Galaxy of Terror and that sort of thing. And there was another one called Inseminoid, and there was another one called Creature, which I think was actually, no, was it Mutant? I can't quite remember. Its original title was Titan Find, which I felt was a much better title. But yeah, they had all these different weird, and wasn't there an Italian movie called Alien 2 on Earth?
Yeah, there was. Yeah. That sounds familiar. Yep.
Yeah, I've never seen it. I must think that I'll find it. But then again, you had the same thing with Star Wars, all the things sort of coming out because of Star Wars, stuff like Battle Beyond the Stars, Humanoid, all that sort of thing. So it's influenced TV and movies for years to come because, like I said earlier, the same with Star Wars, it set a standard. It set a certain standard of science fiction that other people thought, shit, one, yes, it's fantastic and it's inspirational, but two, we could probably make loads of money out of this. So, you know what I mean? off the back of Aliens. But if it influenced me, oh, God. Well, Aliens influenced me more than Aliens originally because I was a 15-year-old when I was 6. I was full of hormones and testosterone. So, yeah, everything to me for the next 20 years was Aliens, guns and, all that sort of stuff. And it wasn't like the past 20 years, probably, that I came to appreciate Alien much more. And that became my favourite movie. And I realised it was actually Alien that was influencing me, the way that I looked at science fiction and design. And that kind of, and the feel of it. So, no, Alien is just right. It's an inspirational movie, but both visually and thematically.
You know, these are films which, you know, if I watch them these days, I've got to watch at least the first three together. You know, it's like when I watch the prequel trilogy of Star Wars, I got to watch all three. You know, it's weird. Yeah. I'm not like the same with the OT. Like I'll do it occasionally, but the prequel trilogy for me just gelled. Certainly better than a certain sequel trilogy, which we won't go into. but I will say this, I think one of the great things about it is it also brought people back to horror. So people went back whether it's reading the great horror stories or the great horrors of the universe stories by H.P. Lovecraft,
Yeah.
You know, the Necronomicon and all that sort of stuff. And, of course, you know, the amazingly, you know, weird sort of, like, stuff out there, you know, like at the Mountains of Madness and all that sort of stuff, you know. Like,
yeah. It's cosmic horror.
Cosmic horror.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I think it just gets out there. Now, of course, this also influenced guys, Mr. Hicks himself, with, of course, Those Dark Places, which really tends to devour that area well.
Well, I had to be honest with myself, I think, at the end. I was trying to develop it's a tabletop role-playing game, and mm-hmm. I was trying to develop a game which is space horror, so monsters and aliens and all this mm-hmm. sort of stuff. But the more I developed it, I had to be honest with myself that I was being influenced more by the idea and the aesthetic of Alien. And films like that, like Outland and Dark Star, and even things like 2010, and Duncan Jones's Moon from a few years ago.
Oh,
that
hell
kind
yes.
of isolation, threats, mm-hmm. you know, even deep space. And then I realised that there were things that were scarier than monsters, and that's just working out in space and trying not to go mad and die. So, and that's basically what, I mean, you can use aliens if you want to in the game, but you don't have to. But the whole aesthetic of the game, that kind of 1980s, 70s, 80s tech, I'm watching a TV show at the moment called For All Mankind, and it's like what would happen if the space race had never ended.
Gotcha.
And if the Russians had gotten to the moon first. It's really, really good. And I'm in 1984 at the moment, I think, and things are going wrong. But there's that kind of tech, so you've got it's all very sort of old school and CRT screens, and everything's a lever and a clunky button. And you know, you don't want sort of massive 3D holographic projectors as your data files, because mm-hmm. then you know you need somebody with a PhD to fix it if anything goes wrong.
Yeah.
So everything you've got on this ship is clunky and it's replaceable, and even you as a person is replaceable as well. So so I went for that aesthetic, that kind of blue collar. Feel to it. And yeah, the biggest influence on that, both sort of, like I say, thematically and visually, aesthetically, was Alien. And I think I had to own up to that. You know, I kept trying to do something different, a bit of a twist on it. Mm. And I thought, no, just own it. Go with it. Just go with what that was created in that film and do something with it. And that's exactly what I did. So it's had a massive influence on me in many respects. Movies, TV shows, written words, even music. James Horner's music from Aliens, and especially Jerry Goldsmith's music from Alien, have been a massive influence on me on my tastes. So it's a stunning piece of work.
It's huge. And I think one of the things is, too, it made me want to read and, really read a lot of the horror stuff that was out. And may I say, a certain amazing writer, Alan Dean Foster, for his novelizations, which really just enriched that area. And now, I've got to say, back in 2013, when he did come out for a Star Trek convention out here in Australia, he was showing off the motion picture. Quite a funny story in itself, folks, because when he was out here for it, he said, mate, I've got the new remastered edition. We're going to put it up on the screens for you. It's going to be fantastic. Paramount have been kind enough to give us the first print of it to put up there, and we're like, oh, this is going to be great. And he's there with his microphone up the front going, righto, you want me to talk about the new movies? No worries. First thing he said, Red Matter's bullshit. That's the first thing he said. You know, and I'm like, yes! You know, he goes, yeah, it's just JJ trying to be, you know, smart. And the next thing was, what do you think of it? He goes, yep, it's bullshit. Like, you know, like, he said, no nonsense guy. I like him, you know?
Yeah.
But then
he fostered my writing heroes, actually. He did so much stuff in the 80s that I read. I mean, loads of movie tie-in novelizations. I recently just picked up the Outland novelization.
Oh, that's a great one. Yeah.
Oh, man, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. It really, really... Oh, see, you've got that one. And there's the book.
Hell yes.
It's available for radio. But there's the book, and I found it completely by accident. And because that's part of my own personal headcanon trilogy, Blade Runner, Outland.
Oh, hell yes.
Yeah. Absolutely adore. And but Alan Dean Foster... Yeah, the work that he did with Alien, and Alien especially, Alien 3, because he put in all the stuff which they cut out of the film, and I remember thinking if they'd left that in the film, it would have been much better, and then they released the assembly cut, and it was much better. But the work they did in Alien, the way he fleshed everything out and made things feel just so much bigger than they actually were in the film, you generally do so much in the movie. Of course, in the written word, you can do pretty much anything you want. And he was fantastic for it. He was absolutely brilliant. And Dean Foster is an absolute hero of mine. Absolutely wonderful, wonderful writer.
And it's good to see that Disney finally coughed up the bucks and paid him.
They did pay him, but I think there's still a lot of artists out there that are still waiting for their fair share.
So, I know the guy from...
I'm glad he...
Who else was it? It was the writer of Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. I think those guys are finally get their money too. So those novelizers. It'll come to me. He's on my friends list, actually. But I remember them posting that they've finally got their stuff out there. So good on them, because they bloody worked hard for it. And
those guys were instrumental in bringing that. Because, I mean, we didn't have the internet back then. We didn't have access to all this media that we've got now. So those guys were instrumental in bringing those stories to us. The consumer, you know what I mean, from writing that and getting it out there and expanding on those worlds and just making it accessible. They were responsible for 2 decades at least of getting those stories into our hands until the internet came along and made things a lot more easier.
And enriching our stories, you know, like it's I think that's the, you know, if I look at the one thing I've always looked back on is the amount that we got. James Caan, there you go, that's the guy.
There we go.
Return of the Jedi. But yeah, like, but chatting to him, and even he said himself, you know, like, those were one of the more fun novelizations to do. And then only a few years later, he then does Chronicles of Riddick for David Tui, which I'm going to say, David Tui's another one who's done an amazing job. And folks, the third movie is the best. The third.
Yeah, the first movie will always be my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
So well, and it took completely blindsided me. I wasn't expecting it. It came out of nowhere. I saw it on a video shop. I didn't even realise it was out. That's how bad life was before the internet. So, I remember seeing that. The Chronicles of Riddick, the second film, I actually enjoyed.
Yeah.
But I couldn't quite see what was going with it. And it was a good film. But I'm one of those guys who think that sometimes these low-budget directors, if they're given a big budget, then things get a little bit out of hand.
They got lost.
I think that's what happened with Chronicles of Riddick. Visually, it was amazing. I loved the idea behind it.
Closest to June. It's got such a Dune feel about it. That's why I liked it.
Exactly that. The entire fit, the design of the Necromongers and their ships especially, the way the ships were bowing to the guy who was walking along, it's so well visualised. But then the third one comes along and it's like, they've cut the budget down a little bit. Then they've given it back to him and then he's gone back to the original movie and said, okay, what made that fun? And he's done that again. And the third film is really, really good. It does suffer a little bit from ego in some respects. I do think some of the stuff that happens is a bit weird, but then if you're Vin Diesel, you're going to get to call the shots, aren't you? But it's such a good film. And there's a couple of revelations in there, which is really, really, and visually, again, really, really well made. Yeah. David Tui is a really good director, but I think he works best with a smaller budget. I think Arrival's a great film. The Charlie Sheen movie, remember that one?
That's a great movie. Yeah, great.
It's a great little film. And what's the submarine one? Was it Down Below?
I think so. Down Below, I think it was.
I think it was Down Below, yeah. Visually, really, really well shot in such a confined space and such a tight budget. Especially, I mean, Pitch Black was shot on such a low budget. And it's, there's parts of it where you're thinking, how did he manage that? You know what I mean? It looks fantastic.
Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, that's where it was filmed.
Oh, right, gotcha.
South Australia.
No, really, it must be bloody hot there. Yeah.
Cooper Petey. Yeah, it's very, very hot out there. Very, very hot. It's where they also did Gallipoli.
Yeah, Gallipoli's a fantastic movie. The Mel Gibson Gallipoli, yeah?
You're correct, yep. That's the one, yep.
Yeah. Excellent film.
It's great films. But
that's my passion for Alien.
you really have. I mean, it's your kit and caboodle, as we say out here. You know, it's always been a fascination for you, and I think... One of the things we need to look at, folks, is the fact that this film, you know, will always be copied. It's something that really, I mean, it is a haunted house horror film in a space station, or in this case, a spaceship. And it's done it incredibly well. It's very effective. And again, you got to look at the source. The source is Texas Chain Massacre. I mean, it really is. It's Texas Chain Massacre in space.
Mm-hmm. It's a slasher flick. They're basically, a bunch of people stuck in the house and they're being chased around and they can't get out. And I think that's exacerbated even more. It's made even more effective by the fact they're on a spaceship. Mm. So they can't just smash a door out or jump out of a window and run down the street and shout for help. That's what gives it its edge. It's out in the middle of nowhere. That's why the thing works so well. Because they are literally out in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of a storm, and nobody's coming. They've got to deal with it themselves or they don't deal with it at all. So, and that's what gives it its edge. That's what makes it terrifying. And that's why it works so well with Aliens. Aliens, you've got a bit of a comfort blanket because it's a bit more of an open space. You can go outside if you have to. You've got a spaceship in orbit and you've got big guns. So there's a little bit, I wouldn't say they were safer. Well, they weren't safer because they put a civilian in charge taking care of defence and you completely forgot about the fact they could get into the ceiling. But that's absolutely fine. Don't worry about that. But the thing with Aliens is like a bit of a comfort blanket. And then with Alien 3, they tried to go back to the original field of Alien and say, yeah, you're trapped. And not only is she trapped there with the alien, she's also trapped with a bunch of criminals. And we see what happened in certain scenes where they try to take advantage of her. It's like double trouble. And Wailing Yutani is on its way, triple trouble. So, it's a bit of a danger, but there was just certain things about that film which pulled you out of the story straight away at the very beginning with Hicks and Newt's death. Mm. But Alien will always be, it will always be, it is the perfect film for me, but it will always be the best ever representation and rendition of the alien as this mysterious, strange, unknowable, unguessable creature. Who basically just wants to take your face off.
Oh, totally.
And won't feel bad doing it.
So, final question of the night is, who's more of a scumbag, do you think? Carter Burke or Peter Weyland?
Peter Weyland, I'll say Burke, because Burke knew what was happening. And he knew what was coming and what was going to happen. And then even after the realisation that all this was true and all this was going on, he then tried to get Ripley and Newt infected. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. that's the scumbag. Whereas Peter Weyland, he didn't know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
He thought he would turn up, speak to what he saw as the creator, and then they would go, yeah, he's eternal life for you, because he just didn't want to die.
That's
Burke
right.
was motivated by money and greed, and Peter Weyland was motivated by the fact that he was just scared to death. And he obviously wanted the answers. I don't think Peter Weyland realised just how deep and how dangerous these things were. He was just looking for answers. Burke knew what the situation was. He knew what the problem was. And even when they realised things were going to go to hell and everyone was going to explode and die, he still tried to get the aliens smuggled through ICC quarantine. And it's like, for God's sake, mate, just let it go. What's wrong with you? I'd say Burke was the biggest scumbag.
Oh, without a doubt. All right, before we wrap, folks, we got to let you all know where to find Those Dark Places. And, of course, Mr. Hicks himself on the web. Mate, let us know. Let it rip.
I hang out mostly on Twitter. You'll find me at John Mark Hicks. That's JonMarkHicks. Because my second name is Hicks. No relation. my username on Twitter is Someone Wake Up Hicks. but you can find my book pretty much anywhere. You type in Those Dark Places RPG. That's Role Playing Game, not Rocket Power Grenade. And you will find it at most game stores, places like Amazon and Barnes & Noble, basically anywhere that they sell books, all from Osprey Publishing's main website. And it's available in hardback, ebook, Kindle, EPUB, and PDF.
Awesome.
Mobi. No, I don't think it is. Either way, you'll find it. If you want a format, I'm sure you'll find it.
Nice. Folks, check it out. I have. It's awesome, and it's well worth it. Particularly if you're into those films. I mean, you could have a whole Outland sort of scenario in that universe too, any of those sorts of things. You're going to go Wild West in out there?
There's a gaming group called Infinite Monkey Tales, and they've actually done their own version of Outland using those Dark Places rules. And, I thought it worked really well, so good on them.
Nice. So go and check it out, folks. It's a lot of fun playing in particularly in those, because it's different from your D&D and, Warhammer and all that sort of stuff that's out there. And I tell you what, there's a lot more out there for you. I mean, I've just seen the new Ravenloft, actually, for D&D 5.
Yes, a very, very pretty looking book. I only know Ravenloft from AD&D 2nd Edition. I've actually got it on my shelf up here, along mm-hmm. with the Castles Forlorn supplement. So I haven't actually had a look at it yet. But yeah, very, very pretty looking book.
And I tell you what, folks, this year, what I'm looking forward to is the final release of the Dune RPG, which will be coming out just around the time of the movie.
It's out now.
Is it already out?
It's out now. You can get it. Modiphius Press have released it now. There's physical copies. You can actually get it on PDF and all sorts. It's actually people are posting their pictures now of the book.
Oh, legit.
It's absolutely. I'm still waiting. I'm going to be waiting forever, I think. I'm still waiting for Against the Dark Master, but that's a completely different story.
Bloody hell.
It's just, it looks stunning. The cover, the inside, everything.
Beautiful. That's it. I'm getting it, folks.
June really good.
And I'm sure John will be joining us on the Mullet Guild to chat about this damn well game as soon as possible.
Yes, as soon as I've got my hands on it and I actually have a read of it, et cetera, then yes, I'll be more than happy to come along and chat.
Awesome. And look, if you had your chance, you're sitting in a group of six or seven people with a games master and you're playing Dune, what are you going to be? What type of character?
Oh, my God. What a question. I could be Bene Gesserit. Bene Gesserit would be my question. If I had to choose a house, I would go for Carino.
Mm-hmm.
Just for the sheer melodrama and the underhandedness of the way they do things. So yes, just for the fun of that. But as far as an actual person, what I would actually do, I'd probably just be probably be like Gurney, just teach combat and play a lute. So teach combat and sing as I do it.
The War Master.
If I had to choose, I would go House of Carino. What about yourself?
Oh, I'm going to say, I could easily just go and say, oh, go Fremen or something like that. But no, I'm going to say I'd be a spice trader, because I think if you're a spice trader, you'd be all over the place.
Absolutely. Or just a smuggler, even. Can you imagine that, trying to evade the guild and Chome and all that sort of stuff? That'd be absolutely amazing.
Oh, it's just amazing. All boys and girls, I'm looking at right now, June Adventures in the Imperium. And yes, it looks gobsmackingly beautiful. I think I'm just going to get the PDF downloaded tonight and start cracking.
It looks like a beautiful game. There's a starter set out there as well. Excuse me. I'm getting so excited. I'm full of wind. There's a starter set out there as well. And which you can download it. Just have a quick look. It's using their 2D20 system, which is very good.
Nice.
Obviously, that's it for June. But the starter set is very, very pretty.
Oh my God, it looks gorgeous. I'm going to get into it, folks. I can tell you that. And stay tuned. Yes, Mullet Guild will be back starting the first week of July. And we're going to kick in to gear with some great specials about the merch upcoming, the film itself.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to dig into the first book again for our feelings of it. And, mate, John, jump on when you can.
Absolutely. No problem at all.
Awesome. All right, folks, we're going to leave you. Love you and leave you. Here from the Leela Mullet headquarters in the Quinlan's Canteen of the Gold Coast of Australia. I'm Adam O'Brien. And, of course, with my dear pal, John Hicks. We'll bid you adieu. Catch you next time.
G'day, folks. Hope you're enjoying the great shows here on the Phantom Podcast Network. Be sure to check out all the great shows that we have on offer and subscribe on the master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. You can check Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast hosted by Kevin the Raider Nerd Rice and Lee Fillingsus on their platform. You can also check out Culture Clash, which is the weekly look at pop culture hosted by Kevin and Kyle. Couch Potato Theatre, this is a cult classics and guilty pleasure podcast. Also Time Wars, Fandom Flashback show. Enzo, a look at the NFL, the American football. Also, Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, looking at the great films of Alfred Hitchcock. Union Federation podcast, a Star Trek and Orville podcast, looking at Discovery, and of course, Picard, plus the Orville. Also, the Hair Metal podcast, looking at the great shows put on by the amazing bands back in the late 80s, their discs, their LPs, everything, all covering the fashion as well. Hosted by Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel. You can also check out Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, hosted by Kevin and Dan Hadley, looking at all the eras of Doctor Who. You can also catch out What a Piece of Junk, a Star Wars podcast, an amazing show looking at Star Wars, hosted by Derek and Scott. And of course, our newest one, the amazing, The Mullet Guild, an offshoot of the Leela Mullet podcast, looking at Frank Herbert's Dune universe. This is like an encyclopedia for Dune, where I take you through and down into the rabbit hole of Frank Herbert's amazing space opera, the sprawling universe which is going to be brought to life by Denis Villeneuve and December 18. You can check out all the shows there. Be sure to also go onto the social platforms on Twitter at FanPod Network. Let us know what you think of the shows and what else you can look at. There you can also check out great articles that we put up through there that we share. Also check out on Instagram and Facebook, Phantom Podcast Network. be sure to make sure that every Tuesday you check out the great work done by Making Treks as well. A brand new podcast looking at a deep dive of Star Trek, hosted by myself, James Semple, and of course, the ever popular and amazing writer of Star Trek and Star Wars, Mark Newbold. Go and check it out, folks, and we'll catch you next time here on the Phantom Podcast Network's The Lethal Mullet Podcast. Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.